Good evening, friends. As Peter announced, the title of my presentation tonight is Navigating in Two Worlds. We don't want to make anybody seasick, but we'll be looking at some aspects of the teachings. I think it is a very familiar concept to all of us that as human beings at this stage of our existence, we are living simultaneously in two worlds. The material world, discernible through sense perceptions of various kinds, and the spiritual world, the world of spiritual values, quantities, and the like, intrinsically not discernible through the senses, but evident through its effects, which of course impinge on the senses. It also is apparent to us that these two worlds in which we are now dwelling at this time interact closely with each other. In some ways, the interaction is obvious. We know that if you steal a material action, it has adverse spiritual consequences. If you kill, if you commit what we call crimes, these are spiritually detrimental. There are a lot of things that are fairly obvious. But some of it is very mysterious. For example, let me take some extreme examples. In the Kitab-e-Kan, Baha'u'llah refers to the fact that before a manifestation appears, a star appears in the visible heavens, heralding unto the people the advent of that most great light. He goes on to point out that there is also a star in the invisible heaven, the forerunner and the like, but it is apparent from the context that he is referring not only to the symbology of a forerunner, but also to an actual star in the heaven appearing with the coming of the manifestation. And we ask ourselves, how are we to explain that? What does it say about astronomy? Astronomy is a fairly exact science. One can predict the motion of the various elements of the astronomical universe very precisely centuries into the past and ahead. How do we explain this concept of which Baha'u'llah speaks, and so on in other aspects of the teachings? In the Dawnbreakers, we have the incident of the Bab being transported into Azerbaijan, and he is a guest, so-called, of the prince in Urmia at one time, and I think you're familiar with the story where the prince wants to humiliate the Bab, and he arranges for his wildest horse to be brought and the Bab to be invited to ride it. And the population are tipped off and they turn up in great numbers to see what happens. The Bab approaches the horse. The horse is calm and docile. How are we to explain it? What does it mean? How did it happen? What was the causative relationship between the approach of the spiritual being, the Bab, the manifestation of God, and what effect did it have on this animal aspect of creation? And likewise, many other such examples. In Dawnbreakers, there is a record of the martyrdom of the Bab in Tabriz, and Nabil, as translated by the Guardian, says, "The very moment the shots were fired, a gale of exceptional severity arose and swept over the whole city. A whirlwind of dust of incredible density obscured the light of the sun. The entire city remained enveloped in darkness from noon till night." How do we explain it? What was the connection? You can say, well, it was happenstance, and this is really stretching statistics rather far. The context of Dawnbreakers indicates that it was a significant event, that it was a reaction of the physical universe to the martyrdom of the manifestation of God, and we inquire what is the causative relationship and what does it tell us about the mystery of the interaction between spiritual spiritual values, spiritual events, and the material world. Likewise, there are innumerable examples in our writings where material actions, we are told, have a profound spiritual effect. Abdu'l-Bahá says in one place, even in the physical realm, cleanliness will conduce to spirituality, as the holy writings clearly state. How do we explain that? What is the connection between whether I'm clean or dirty, scrubbed or unscrubbed? Why should that have any effect on my spirituality, the content of my spiritual being, my degree of spiritual development? What is the connection? I mention this as an example of the mystery of the interaction between the material and spiritual worlds. The same, of course, one can go on all night talking about such examples, Hekukala, and the fact that our writings tell us that those who observe Hekukala become firm and steadfast, and that it exerts a great influence on their hearts and souls. Obviously, it's good to give money to one's religion. Obviously, it's an act of devotion. But what is the connection? How does it all work? These are some of the mysteries between the interaction of the material and spiritual worlds. Humanity has wrestled with this down through the ages. It has led to some very interesting lines of thinking, some very interesting schools of philosophy, but it's also led to a great deal of superstition. People have, through their inferences based upon deductions from what they've observed in the world, come up with false generalizations which lead them to superstitious events. You know, people say, if I wash the car, it'll therefore rain. And this is something that people observe in practice, and therefore to some extent it takes a hold of them. And there are other more interesting and more unusual superstitions than that. It leads to the use of talismans or lucky charms or things you carry around with you, because that way luck comes to you. Find a number of sportsmen who say that they will make sure they have this particular object with them when they're out on the sports field, because they always get good luck when it comes. It's all part of the challenge of humanity wrestling with the fact that it has to deal with the interaction between the material world and its awareness, to some extent incomplete, that there is a spiritual world out there of great mystery. What we want to do is to explore that tonight. There are two ways of doing it. One way is to catalogue the Baha'i teachings, because the central purpose of religion, the central purpose of the Baha'i revelation, is to give us guidance how to steer a course through the material world in a way which maximizes our spiritual development. And that's one approach, and it's obviously a very valid approach, because that's why the revelation has been given to us. The approach I want to adopt tonight is to advance to you the thesis that one can derive from the writings a small number of fundamental principles which underlie the issue of the relationship between the material and spiritual world. I offer this not as a way of avoiding referring to the teachings, but rather as a way of hopefully getting deeper insight into the nature of teachings, some of which may seem a little odd at first sight, like this cleanliness, spirituality, duality, and so on. So, in a moment, I want to address three principles which I think underlie the relationship between the material and spiritual worlds. And depending how much time there is, then we'll look at a couple of applications of these principles. Before I do that, I might say that the world around us has adopted commonly two approaches to this question in the present day. The most common approach is essentially to deny the existence of the spiritual world. In other words, a materialistic outlook on life. There are a lot of people who are avowedly materialistic, who say all that other stuff is hooey, it's all imagination and nothing, anything that cannot be proved through the scientific method, which depends upon perception of senses and the effect on instruments. Anything other than that doesn't have a real existence. You can't prove it, therefore you should ignore it, this kind of thing. So a common approach in the present day is very pragmatic, based upon what is immediately before one's eyes and is essentially materialistic. The other approach, less common, but growing as a reaction to the materialistic approach, is the opposite. To regard the material world as intrinsically antithetical to spiritual development. Anything to do with the material world is going to divert me from my aim of spiritual development. In its most extreme form, you find it leads to asceticism, imposing severe discipline upon oneself on the grounds that this will make one more spiritual. It underlies the sort of theory of celibacy in some religious orders as a means of becoming more spiritual by denying anything to do with sexual activity. It also underlies the deliberately seeking of pain or self-flagellation as a means of becoming more spiritual. And withdrawal from the world, going to live in a monastery or retiring to a cave or something like that, on the grounds that the more I get away from the world, the more spiritual I'll become. We obviously are not part of that extreme reaction against the material world, but occasionally one comes across something which echoes it. For example, the confusion between material possessions and materialism. The tendency to view anybody who's materially well endowed as therefore materialistic is an echo of that philosophic point that the material world is intrinsically anti-spiritual and therefore get away from it. There is a sense of, in some quarters, of a distrust of wealth, a dislike of engagement in business practices on the grounds that because business is apparently material and concerned with material things, therefore it must be unspiritual. These are echoes of this false view of rejection of the material world on the grounds that it is unspiritual. And of course, you have situations like those of the Amish in Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia, who deliberately choose not to use modern technology. And from best I understand it, this is because they feel that by reverting to a more medieval forms of technology, they are rejecting things which will take them away from the spiritual world. Well, so much for those various approaches. We need not detain ourselves with further exploration of them, but let's move on to these three underlying principles which I believe illuminate the issue of how we can best negotiate our way while simultaneously living in a material and a spiritual world. Some of these three, or all of these three principles, may well be obvious to some of you, and you may well find this is no more than just a review of things you already know. If that's the case, you should feel free to switch on your cell phone. Okay, let's take the three principles. The first one is the illumination that the writings, Baha'i writings, provide to us of the nature of the material world. The writings tell us very clearly that the material creation is not evil. We do not believe in independent force of evil. So it's not a point of rejecting it or anything like that. The true purpose of the material world, we're told, is in the hidden words, I've ordained for thy training every atom in existence and the essence of all created things. It is here for our training, which implies, of course, we must involve ourselves in it. We're told further that, and this is just a review, that man or human beings have two natures, a spiritual nature and a material nature. And the material nature is not necessarily concerned with material objects, but the writings tell us that the material nature inclines us to want to live for the world alone. In other words, a question of values and priority of values. Having said all that, we are confronted immediately with a rather awkward problem. And the awkward problem is in Gleanings, where Baha'u'llah tells us to free ourselves from the bondage and corruption of the world. And we might say, oh dear, oh dear, here we are saying that the material world is not intrinsically evil for our training and we're free to involve ourselves in it. Now we come across this big roadblock saying that we should free ourselves from the bondage to and corruption of the world. The answer to this dilemma, as the answer to most other dilemmas in the writings, is just keep reading. Because you find a little further down in Gleanings, Baha'u'llah says, and I quote, by the world is meant your unawareness of him who is your maker, your absorption in aught else but him. This is a point for a big sigh of relief, because it is by the world is not meant the material creation, it is rather unawareness of him who is your maker, absorption in aught else but him. In other words, a sense of priority and a sense of values. And we cannot take the first passage about freeing oneself from the bondage of the world to justify any kind of abandonment of involvement in creation. What we find then is that this attitude toward the world as being for our training, for our development, not intrinsically evil, underlies a variety of Baha'i teachings. It underlies the fact that we are commanded to give rise to an ever-advancing civilization. It underlies the fact that in the Kitab-i Aqdas, Baha'u'llah admonishes us to devote ourselves to the development of cities. And it also underlies the statements of the Guardian in Unfoldment of World Civilization, where he speaks of the golden age of the cause, and he defines the things we're going to be doing, or the people of the future are going to do at that time, which are things very involved with society, with the world, with its rectification and development, with intellectual pursuits, with scientific research, with improving the efficiency of agriculture and all kinds of things. All of those things rest upon our view of the world and our inhibition, our abhorrence of forsaking the world and seeking refuge from it. There are a variety of passages, which I won't read here throughout the writings, which very explicitly reject any form of asceticism. Some of these are very explicit. In the Aqdas, where Baha'u'llah refers to how many a man has secluded himself in the climes of India, denied things that God has decreed as lawful, imposed upon himself austerities and mortifications and has not been remembered by God. And then other places where Baha'u'llah says living in seclusion or practicing asceticism is not acceptable unto God. This refusal of Baha'u'llah to condone, much less endorse, asceticism turns up in some more intriguing ways. For example, in the questions and answers to the Actus, I find great significance in question 97 and the response given by Baha'u'llah, where he was asked about washing one's feet in winter and summer. And the answer given by Baha'u'llah is that warm water is preferable, but there can be no objection to cold. Now, this seems like a very amusing thing, and why is this in such a holy book, and so on, so forth. Nevertheless, I see it as highly significant, as closing the door to fanaticism, to mortification of the flesh, as it would be if, say, tomorrow morning, just wash your feet with cold water, and you know exactly what I mean. That it closes the door to a whole line of practice which has been regarded conventionally as part of exalted religious activity for centuries and probably thousands of years in this one statement of Baha'u'llah, this kernel truth about using warm water. Is it, take it easy, use warm water. You can use cold if you like, but warm water is preferable. It's a highly significant thing. Even more significant to me is a passage in the Hukukula compilation where Baha'u'llah responds to people who said they had thou hast written that they, whoever it was, have pledged themselves to observe maximum austerity in their lives with a view to forwarding the remainder of their income to His exalted presence. It's people who said, we're going to live really at low level and maximum austerity so we can send as much money as we can to Baha'u'llah. This, his secretary or his amanuensis says, this matter was mentioned at his holy court. He said, let them act with moderation and not impose hardship upon themselves. We would like them both to enjoy a life that is well-pleasing. Again, the refusal to condone asceticism, this degree of austerity carried to an extreme. I had a very interesting experience. I'm so conscious of time, I'm not sure whether I want to take the time for it, but let's do so. Had a very interesting experience just after Janet and I came to the World Center in 1983. In those days, there were no or very few microwave ovens in Israel. We had bought a microwave oven in Australia and we brought it with us and set the thing up in our apartment on Hanadiv. And it was a temporary wonder at the World Center. People would come to our home and we'd take cups of cold water and put them in the microwave oven, and then 1 minute later they'd boil, and it was sort of a wondrous thing, and everyone would be very excited. We never tried a boiled egg. That really would have been exciting, but anyhow. On one occasion we had a group of people to dinner, and one of them who I suspect prided them, well, this is probably a very harsh statement, they seem to have a great interest in spiritual development, raised the question, politely or perhaps semi-politely, that is not a newfangled invention like a microwave oven something which takes away from spiritual development? And we, of course, were totally nonplussed. We didn't know what to say. One of the individuals present who had a very good knowledge of the teachings dredged out in his mind a passage from the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf which answered that objection. You may wish me to read it. Baha'u'llah says, our purpose, he's responding to somebody who talks about learning a bunch of languages, and he says, don't bother. He says, our purpose is that all men may cleave unto that which will reduce unnecessary labor and exertion, so that their days may be befittingly spent and ended. So what we, it's a general statement. He wasn't just talking about languages. He went on to generalize from that. It seems that it is not only appropriate but good for us to use things which reduce unnecessary labor and exertion, provided you use the time usefully. If you use the time just to sleep in bed or watching TV or something, and so what's the point of it? But if you use it usefully, then all things which reduce unnecessary labor and exertion are commendable from that passage. Again, it's part of this refusing to become involved in a rejection of the material world. The second of the three principles that I want to mention tonight is one which will appeal very much to the friends here who serve in the correspondence office, because it is a passage where Abdu'l-Bahá refers to the relationship between the material and spiritual worlds, and in Promulgation of Universal Peace, he says, the world of matter is an outer expression or facsimile of the inner kingdom of spirit. It's a facsimile. He goes on, the whole passage is, the worlds of God are in perfect harmony and correspondence one with another. The physical universe is in perfect correspondence with the spiritual or divine realm. And then he goes on to make this statement that I've quoted, the world of matter is an outer expression or facsimile of the inner kingdom of spirit. He says similar things in other places in Promulgation. He says the spiritual world is like the phenomenal world. They are the exact counterpart of each other. Whatever objects appear in this world of existence are outer pictures of the world of heaven. This sense of facsimile, of one-to-one correspondence, if you will, between the material and spiritual world is a very powerful concept, which I find extremely fascinating. To my mind, it explains why the revelation of Baha'u'llah draws so heavily on natural analogy. This prayer that we read tonight to open the session, been raining down from the clouds, what will cleanse thus and so from you. And you find in the Kitab-i Khan, full of natural analogies, analogies from the world of nature are employed commonly by Baha'u'llah, and I think it rests upon this concept of the correspondence or facsimile between spiritual and material worlds. What that means, among other things, is that the revelation is such that people who live close to nature have a capacity for absorbing deep spiritual truth, irrespective of their formal education. The very fact that they are sensitive to the world of nature, farmers or pursuing other forms of agriculture, hunters if you will, or nomads, it sensitizes them to perceive at a deep level the truths of the revelation by virtue of this facsimile correspondence. It also means that as Baha'is, during this dispensation, we must give great attention to fostering the world of nature. And I think that underlies the fact that so much of our effort of time and resources at the World Center is devoted to the pursuit of nature, with our gardens here in Haifa and at Baji and other places. They are part of our worship, our reverence, but they also make a statement about how much we value the world of beauty and likewise the world of nature. and they are in that sense a pattern for the rest of the world in the value the future society will give to nature. The world of the material world, we know, is infused with power. We are gradually attaining an understanding of the various levels of power which suffuses the entire material creation. Gravitation, electromagnetic energy in various forms and wavelengths, the various forces that are now categorized of strong and weak nuclear forces and all kinds of other things that are just in process of being discovered. It has become clear to people who study these things that we live in a world, material world, infused with power. By the analogy, by the correspondence with the spiritual world, this facsimile thing, the writings tell us that the spiritual creation, spiritual world, is also infused with power. Abdu'l-Bahá says, look at this endless universe. A universal power inevitably exists which encompasses all, directing and regulating all parts of the infinite creation. In another place he says, the greatest power is the realm and range of human existence. Excuse me, I read it wrongly. The greatest power in the realm and range of human existence is spirit, the divine breath which animates and pervades all things. It's manifested through creation in different degrees or kingdoms. So there the analogy or the correspondence between material and spiritual worlds extends to the level not only of its dimensions but also of its power. So we have two of the three principles, the first being concerned with the fact that the material world's for our training and it's not evil and so on, and the second is the facsimile between material and spiritual worlds. The third of the three principles I want to mention is contained in statements of the writings which refer to interconnectedness. And Abdu'l-Bahá says, it is obvious that all created things are connected one to another by a linkage complete and perfect, even as, for example, are the members of the human body. He expands on this in another place where he says, reflect upon the inner realities of the universe, the secret wisdoms involved, the enigmas, the interrelationships, the rules that govern all. Then he goes on to say, for every part of the universe is connected with every other part by ties that are very powerful and which admit of no imbalance nor any slackening whatsoever. What I get from that is Abdu'l-Bahá, and of course it derives from Baha'u'lláh, points out the degree of interconnectedness between all elements of the creation, all elements of the material creation and all elements of the spiritual world. We are gradually becoming familiar with the interconnectedness of all elements of the material creation. The whole concern for ecology in recent decades is a statement of interconnectedness. The derivatives from chaos theory about, you know, the butterfly in China and you get a storms in South America and so on from chaos theory. All of those are examples of looking at interconnectedness. We now become aware of things that happen in distant parts of the universe which affect us on Earth. Bursts of cosmic rays or gamma radiation from pulsars and exploding supernovae and all those kinds of things have an effect on the Earth. We are becoming more and more aware of the interconnectedness of all elements of the physical universe. Likewise, individuals in the spiritual dimension, our religion is concerned with promoting a sense of interconnectedness. The individual is called upon to sensitize himself or herself to feel a connection with nature, to feel a connection with other human beings, to be concerned for their welfare and their well-being and their happiness and not hurting others and the like. There again you have this sense of interconnection. The example of Abdu'l-Bahá can be summarized as an example of the application of interconnectedness in terms of his degree of genuine concern for others rather than focused on himself. Our administrative order has as its aim the creation of an interconnected worldwide community at the various levels. It is something that is very, very common to to all elements of our religion. There are some parts of the interconnectedness that are mysterious. Let me read one of them. It is attributed to Baha'u'llah. It's buried in Star of the West, and it is a statement attributed to Baha'u'llah saying, "The Lord of mankind says that if a person be quick and keen in his powers of perception and discernment, the moment a godly person enters his house, he will perceive that the air becomes fragrant and the taste of his food and drink becomes delicious, pleasant and exhilarating. While on the contrary, if an ungodly person enters, the air becomes oppressive and the food loses its flavour." And of course now we want to Peter May to exclude the wrong people from the kitchen. This interconnectedness between the material elements of creation and their spiritual underlies in many ways our approach to social and economic development. As the House of Justice pointed out in its message of October 1983, launching the new phase of social economic development, we aim to produce what it described as a dynamic coherence between the material and spiritual dimensions of creation. And this dynamic coherence seems to me to involve not simply interconnectedness, but a degree of synchronism in the operation of the interconnected elements. So much for the three basic principles that I wanted to share with you tonight. There seems to be some time left, so I want to go on to talk about the applications, particularly of the principle of facsimile, the principle of the correspondence between the material and spiritual world. And I want to share with you my understanding of a statement that I find in the writings explained fairly fully by Abdu'l-Bahá, which seems to illuminate a whole lot of teachings under the heading of the correspondence between the material and spiritual worlds. And it's something which I have called the magnetic principle. Let me read to you what Abdu'l-Bahá says, which I take to be a description of the magnetic principle. He says, "When existing elements are gathered together according to the natural order and with perfect strength, they become a magnet for the spirit, and the spirit will become manifest in them with all its perfections." What I get from that is that there is a great law of the universe which says that if elements of creation are arranged in a divinely prescribed pattern, they attract an energizing force or spirit. It is so crucial to what I want to say for the next few minutes that I I'll ask your indulgence to let me repeat it. If the elements of creation are arranged in a divinely prescribed pattern, they attract an energizing force or spirit. And I take it to be that's what Abdu'l-Bahá says here when he says, and I read it again, existing elements are gathered together according to the natural order with perfect strength. They become a magnet for the spirit, and the spirit will become manifest in them with all its perfections. This is a fairly difficult concept to grasp. Because what it is saying is you take a whole bunch of elements of the creation, and this will become clear in a moment, and you arrange them according to a divinely prescribed pattern, and bless my heart, there is a spirit associated with them. If the pattern is of this kind, you get that kind of spirit. If the pattern is of another kind, you get another kind of spirit, depending upon divine law. So the writings use the term magnet to describe it, because the magnet is a collection of atoms which are arranged in a prescribed pattern, and you get magnetic force associated with it. And this is mysterious. You say, where did this thing come from? We had a bunch of atoms, there was no sign of the magnetic force there. Now we've stuck them together and you get North Pole and South Pole, and the thing sticks to the refrigerator door and so on. The magnetic force is invisible. You can put your hand between it and don't feel anything. We understand it very well. We use it, and it can be very strong. It can be massively strong. Some of you may have read or even seen or been on the maglev train from Shanghai Airport to downtown Shanghai. Great hulking big train. It runs along with magnetic force, stopping it from going down bang onto the rails, above the rails, propelled by held from the rails by magnetic force. It's called the maglev, magnetic levitation train. So magnetic force is not just things sticking to refrigerators. It is rather a very powerful force that can hold a great big train up above the rails. The writings, as I understand it, indicate to me that spirit is manifested according to the divine law. Abdu'l-Bahá develops this to considerable length in his tablet to Dr. Forel. He says, for example, the spirit possesses various grades and stations. And depending upon the divine law, this kind of spirit will be manifested this way and that kind that way. For example, Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to talk about minerals. He says the mineral is an expression of divine law. It has associated with it the power of attraction, without which the mineral or the stone would not exist, but it has within it that power of attraction, which is a form of spirit. In the tablet to Dr. Forel, Abdu'l-Bahá says, as to the existence of spirit in the mineral, it is indubitable that minerals are endowed with a spirit and life according to the requirements of that stage. This is very radical to say that a mineral has life associated with it. And we can all calm down and realize that what he's talking about is life in its very general sense in terms of spirit, that there is a spirit associated with a mineral, and that spirit is manifested in the cohesion of the mineral. And then he goes on again to Dr. Forel by generalizing, saying the existence of beings is conditioned upon coming together of various elements and their non-existence upon the decomposition of constituent elements. He goes on to point out to Forel about the plant, that here we have another kind of divine law, and through the process, the natural process of growth, a plant comes into being, a seed or whatever. It's a collection of atoms. in a certain way, and lo and behold, there is the spirit of the vegetable or the spirit of growth associated with a vegetable. And what is the difference between a vegetable and a mineral? It is the pattern of arrangement of the atoms, and as a result of the pattern in the vegetable, it attracts a vegetable spirit. He then goes on to Farrell and talks about animals having a higher degree than the vegetable kingdom, in that the power of the spirit is manifest even to a greater extent because it conforms to a divine pattern, and so you get the animal with its sense perceptions, and the thing goes moo or bow wow or whatever animals do. And then he goes on to talk about human beings, as there again we have the arrangement of patterns in, say, the fertilized ovum, which have a spirit associated with it, the human spirit. And Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to describe this at some length. From what I can see, he uses the term spirit throughout in the Tablet to Farrell, but he also in other places uses the term love. And you might say, well, spirit is this and love is that. Why is it a connection? And I think love is used in the sense of the power of attraction. That the power of attraction is expressed in the spirit through various ways. And in one place, not in the Tablet of Farrell, he says, love is the most great law that ruleth this mighty and heavenly cycle, the unique power that bindeth together the diverse elements of this material world, the supreme magnetic force that directs the movement of the spheres of the celestial realm. So this principle, deriving from the facsimile relationship of material and spiritual worlds expressed through the magnetic principle, gives us a fundamental understanding of the diversity of the elements of creation, as well as human life, birth, the soul coming into being at the time of conception, death, the transformation of the soul, and the like. It also may well provide insight into questions of the production of life in the test tube and cloning and all kinds of things, but that's of a speculative nature. Now, before we leave that point, why are we spending all this time on these magnets? The answer is that this concept of magnet is used in the writings to explain a whole lot of things. For example, Abdu'l-Bahá refers to Baha'u'lláh as a magnet. He says, the Lord has manifested the magnet of the souls and hearts in the pole of the existing world, to which all sacred hearts are attracted from far distant lands and countries. It's beautifully poetic, but it also conforms to this magnetic principle that I have tried to describe. Baha'u'lláh also uses the term magnet relatively frequently in his writings, and it is translated there as L-O-D-E, stone, lodestone, which is a poetic way of saying magnet. The lodestone is, of course, the ancient term for things used for compasses and the like, having magnetism. Baha'u'lláh says that his revelation, quote, will act as a lodestone for all nations and kindreds of the earth. Again, the magnetic principle used to explain the attractiveness of the power of the revelation, that associated with it is a spiritual power. People say, where is the power in the sacred writings? The sacred writings, say, take Kitab-e-Khan, consists of words that are found in the Oxford English Dictionary. There's no words there that are not in the Oxford English Dictionary, more or less. Forget about Uvatal Vathkahar and stuff like that. There are no words that are not in the Oxford English Dictionary, yet we don't say that the Oxford English Dictionary has a spiritual power associated with it, but we say that the Kitab-e-Khan does. What's the difference? It is the pattern. It is the arrangement of words in the revelation, and that pattern is such that by divine law it attracts a spirit to it. A question has been asked of the guardian about why do we come to the holy shrines? Now, if you or I had that question in our minds, we'd be afraid to ask. But somebody had courageous enough to ask the guardian, why do we come to the holy shrines? Because after all, what's there are the remains of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. Their bodies were composed of atoms like everyone else's atoms, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus, all that kind of stuff. So what? And the guardian's reply was very insightful in writing. He said, the atoms of the prophet are just atoms like all others, but the association of this great spiritual power with them leaves in the place they are laid to rest a tremendous spiritual atmosphere, if one may use this expression. So that these atoms are endowed with a tremendous spiritual influence and far-reaching power. He goes on to say, but the physical character of their atoms are not different from other people's. And again, I see in that the magnetic principle at work. The magnetic principle explains some very strange statements in the writings. One is that of the guardian, where he refers to the Mashriq al-Azkar. And this was a passage written in the 1950s where he called upon us to raise houses of worship in Australia and Germany and in Uganda. And he refers to these three monumental edifices, each designed to serve as a house for the indwelling Spirit of God. That's pretty far out. And here we're told upon to build the houses of worship as we did in those three countries, and we're told that each of those will be a house for the indwelling Spirit of God. Again, I see the magnetic principle at work, that by following divine prescription as given to us by the head of the faith, we are following divine law, and therefore the creation of the atoms that give rise to the Mashriq al-Azkar have associated with it a spirit which the guardian describes as a house for the indwelling Spirit of God. Abdu'l-Bahá had said this in relation to the house of worship in North America. He said, the Mashriq al-Azkar, though outwardly a material foundation, is possessed of spiritual effect. Again, I see the magnetic principle. And so it goes on. Before I leave this, and I've got one point that I can think I can make in the time, but before I leave that, I'd like to share with you a small blizzard of statements from the writings which refer to this magnetic principle. Abdu'l-Bahá says, faith is the magnet which draws the confirmation of the Merciful One. Here the magnetic principle applies to a condition of heart, of spirit. That by adopting a condition of faith, it is a magnet for the spirit. He says, service is the magnet which attracts heavenly strength. In another place he says, the commemoration of God attracts confirmation and assistance like unto a magnet. Again, the magnetic principle. Actions taken in conformity with the divine law attract a spirit like a magnet. He says, unity and harmony is the magnet that draweth down the confirmations of God. He refers to teaching the faith, and he says, when the tongue of the teacher is engaged in teaching, he will naturally himself be stimulated, will become a magnet, attracting divine aid and bounty. And another one, today as never before, the magnet which attracts the blessings from on high is teaching the faith of God. It is in that sense that we can get some insight into the mysterious statement I read at the beginning of the talk, those of you who can remember back that far, were about cleanliness. And I raised the question of why is it that cleanliness has an effect on spirituality? So it seems to me that it is the application of the magnetic principle. The divine law prescribes cleanliness, and as we follow divine law, so it gives rise to attraction of the spirit. Abdu'l-Bahá says, even in the physical realm, cleanliness will conduce to spirituality, as the holy writings clearly state. Although bodily cleanliness is a physical thing, it has nevertheless a powerful influence on the life of the spirit. If we accept the validity of the magnetic principle enunciated by Baha'u'llah, all these things fall into place as simply examples of that universal principle, which in turn derives from the facsimile relationship of matter and spirit and the material and spiritual worlds. This leads me to my final point, and that is another application that I see of the correspondence, the facsimile correspondence between the material and spiritual worlds. And the point I want to make, I can make fairly quickly because it's not very complicated, and it is to refer to the fact that the material world is a world of repetitive or cyclic events, and that the same thing should occur in the spiritual dimension. What I mean is this, that in the material world, the passage of time is marked by rhythmic or repetitive events. For example, in the physical world, it's full of repetitive cycles. Electrons circulating around the nucleus of the atom, even allowing for quantum mechanics and wave theory and all that kind of stuff, nevertheless there is the sense of activity, of the circulation of electrons in various shells and orbits around the atom, leaving aside questions of electron spin. So at the subatomic level we have repetition, cyclic events. We find that at an astronomical level, the movement of the sun and the moon, the movement of the entire solar system revolving, I think was it every 25,000 years, around the galaxy, the center of the galaxy. Beyond that, the movement of clusters of galaxies around a central orbit and these superclusters that are only now being explored astronomically. It is a world of movement. As human beings, we contain with us repetitive motion. The beating of the heart, the repetitive events, the cyclic nature of the heartbeat, the so-called rhythms within the day, which are given the fancy term of circadian rhythms, rhythms that occur every day. Medical professionals tell us that the various secretions of the glands and whatever have a daily variation, a daily rhythm. And medicines taken at a certain time of the day will have more effect than taken at another time of the day because of the daily fluctuations, which are part of the rhythm of the body. And of course, there are seasonal effects and there are lunar influences, lunar effects on the minuscule tides within the human cell and things like that. The Baha'i view of history is also rhythmic. We talk about the succession of dispensations, each with its concept of resurrection and return. There's a cyclic element there, as well as a sense of rhythm. We have the cycles of prophecy, the cycles of fulfillment, and then the universal cycle of over 500,000 years. After that, everything gets obliterated and the whole thing starts up again. So much for the physical world. What we find is in the spiritual dimension, so many of our teachings call for rhythmic activity. The rhythm of daily prayer, the daily obligatory prayers, the rhythm of reading the sacred writings every day, the rhythm of bringing oneself to account each day as advocated in the writings, the cycles of the 19-day feast, the annual cycle of holy days, of intercalary days, and of the period of the fast. All of these cycles represent the correspondence between our spiritual activity and the material world. And now it is fascinating to see that through the intelligent and intensive efforts of the International Teaching Centre in the application of the core activities of the five-year plan, we have developed intensive programs of growth which are of a cyclic nature. Through the process of learning, we have been guided to see that the cyclic activity should apply to that as well as to these other aspects of our spiritual activity. The point I want to make as I conclude is that the Guardian has referred to this rhythmic activity in a way which I personally believe to be of general applicability. I'll share with you very briefly what the Guardian says, and then I want to make the point that my personal view is that that can be generalized to other aspects of our spiritual activity, but that's just a personal view. So the Guardian, in this decisive hour, refers to opposition to the faith. And basically what he says is whenever opposition occurs, the believers rally themselves, make a supreme effort to deal with it. Their actions attract the power of the Holy Spirit and they overcome their adversary. Propelled by that spirit, they go on to even greater victories. These greater victories raise up new hostility. The believers gird their loins, make an effort to deal with it. Their efforts attract the Holy Spirit. They overcome the new adversaries, go on to even greater victories, which, you know, one can go on for a long time, go on for another hour if you like, on this, you know, so the cycle he points to is that of effort to advance a spiritual principle leading to barriers created and then having to overcome them, attracting the spirit and leading to greater spiritual victories. The Guardian, I didn't read the passage because it's very hard to read, you've really got to sit down and look at it, but the Guardian says the resistless march of the faith of Baha'u'llah, which he's just described in that way, resolves itself into a series of rhythmic pulsations. And it seems to me that this same sense of rhythmic pulsations applies to our personal spiritual practice. Some minutes ago I read about magnets, how the magnet, faith attracts the magnetic, in a magnetic way attracts the spirit. Well, if life was as simple as that, it would really be easy. You have a certain degree of faith, you attract a certain amount of spirit, you go on to become even deeper in faith, that attracts a greater measure of spirit, that makes you even more deep in faith, attracts a greater measure of spirit, and the whole thing goes on. Well, you know, it's not like that, because there are tests and trials and attempts to deviate you from the path because of one's material nature. In that sense, it seems to me that the model given by the guardian for the external activity in relation to adversaries applies also to the internal activity in which we're dealing with the opposition of our material nature to spiritual practice. We decide that we're going to say the obligatory prayer each day. We do it and it attracts the spirit. But then our material nature gets in the way. Tonight I'm sleepy, I'm going to go to bed. It's too late for the short obligatory prayer and I can't be bothered saying the long obligatory prayer. So you sort of deal with it the best way you can. We do have the opposition of our material nature and we strive to overcome that. We attract spiritual power, go on to greater victories, but they will raise further barriers which we will overcome through attracting the spirit in the magnetic sense and going on to even greater victories on the path of spiritual development. So in that sense, the sense of rhythmic pulsation seems to me to apply to our personal spiritual activity as well as to the larger sort of macroscopic development of the faith all over the world. So much for steering one's course through the material and spiritual worlds. There's a lot more to it, but I hope I've been able to at least introduce you to a subject which I find intensely fascinating. Thank you.